From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. Of course, along with your calls, Zorba, some topics to talk about.
Yes, we're going to talk about fast food in children, whether or not people, parents, are making good options and choices for their children, what it means. And we're going to talk about mother thing for kids, limiting screen time, brain function and screen time for children. And what does that mean about brain function and screen time for you?
That's really interesting. What's her recipe?
Lemony zucchini pasta. Zucchini is great. You will love lemony zucchini pasta, even though it's past zucchini season for many of us. Some of us still like zucchini,
My last zucchini season was, I think it was 1975.
That's probably it. You know, you don't have the neighbor like I have who just drops off, hey, you want some zucchini? Drops off a bag of zucchini at the house, and I go, what am I going to do with this? You know, zucchini bread, zucchini for breakfast, zucchini for lunch, zucchini for dinner.
Let's go to the phones at 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, our first caller, joins us now from Searing, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, my question is probably a very simple one. I want to know about grapefruit juice and certain medications.
Sure,
Mm-hmm. Why can't you, why not lemons and oranges and pineapples, any other citrus fruit? Why just grapefruit?
Sure, that's exactly. You think it's an anti-grapefruit cabal that's just against the grapefruit. So why do you ask? You like grapefruit juice?
I love grapefruit.
Yeah, clearly. You know, it's the grapefruit lovers in America who are really up in arms with exactly that. So I've got a question. How much grapefruit juice do you drink?
Oh, well, I don't now because I'm taking medication. I can't.
Uh-huh. Okay. So there are a couple of things about grapefruit. First of all, what they found, this is probably now 2 decades ago, they found that grapefruit juice is different from the other citrus juices in that it can change the metabolism of certain drugs. Not all drugs, but certain drugs. And the metabolism changes for a period of time between when you take the drug and you take the grapefruit juice. And it's the amount of grapefruit juice can change the amount of metabolism of the drug. So some drugs will have higher levels. Now, it actually has to do with something complex, which has to do with the liver, and it's the P450 enzyme system. Tom has to memorize this because it's on the test today. Can't get out of the studio until P450. You've already lost the, you know, you've gotten a zero on the quiz.
Another F for me.
F for Tom, which is his middle initial anyway. But anyway, it's right. We won't mention what the name means. But anyway, the P450 system metabolizes a variety of drugs. It's an enzyme system in the liver, and it's affected by grapefruit juice. Why? It just is, and the other citrus juices do not affect it. But the amount of grapefruit juice and how closely you actually drink the juice to the drug that you're taking can be part of the issue. And the way to figure that out is actually talk to your pharmacist. How many medicines are you on?
Three.
Uh-huh. Yeah, are you on a statin? Is that one?
Yeah, that's the one. I'm on the simvastatin.
Yeah, the statin often. When do you take your statin?
I take my statin nighttime before I go to bed.
Yeah. You know, I tell my patients, if things are fine, you can have 4 to 6 ounces of grapefruit juice in the morning. I don't think that's going to have much effect. I don't think you could probably take 4 to 8 ounces in the morning. You could take some at noon. Now, your pharmacist and doctor may disagree, but there's no evidence. How many milligrams are you on? What's the drug you're on?
It's 20 milligrams
of simvastatin or atorvastatin
at bedtime.
at bedtime. You should have no trouble. You may have the equivalent, in other words, because it changes the metabolism, it may make it the equivalent of 30 to 40 milligrams of the same drug, but frankly, people tolerate that well. So my advice to you, if you came to my office and you said, can I take grapefruit juice, I would say you can have 4 to 6 ounces in the morning. You can even have 4 to 6 ounces at lunch, and just don't take it when you take your statin at bedtime, and that will improve your life. And when you're happier, you live longer.
Well, you're right about that.
And you can have grapefruit in the morning, too, if you like grapefruit.
Okay. Yeah.
That
yeah,
is the other thing. So I'm glad to help you.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. You
take
care.
Have a great day.
You too.
Yeah, thanks. We appreciate that call at 800-462-7413.
You know, that particular question comes up quite often. And the reason why, among other things, some people actually drink 8 ounces, 12 ounces of grapefruit juice 3 to 4 times a day. And for those people, it can really make a difference in the metabolism of their drug. But for people who would take a juice glass once or twice a day and they're doing it 8 or 12 hours away from their taking a pill, no problem. And there are so many grapefruit juice lovers in this country that we could make happier with this simple thing. Now, do you like grapefruit juice?
I do. I love grapefruit.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. What, do you drink it very much?
Not much, but I like it a lot.
You like it a lot. Yeah, I happen to like grapefruit juice. It's tangy.
Zorba, before our next call, we have a food question. Food and kids eating fast food.
Now, I know it will shock you, but let's talk about fast food. You know, fast food, we know on the whole fast food isn't good for you. So you go to McDonald's, you go to Burger King, you go to Wendy's, you go to Subway, you bring your kids there, and you say, oh, they're going to have a good healthy meal because they have healthy meals at these places. Guess what percentage of the kids end up not eating healthy meals? In other words, eating junky meals. They've got parents. They go in there. What percentage of the kids do not eat healthy meals?
Probably a lot, although there's been a lot of talk about making
the meals
kids
healthier.
Eat healthier
That's
food.
Exactly. Yeah, well, the studies have shown, this recent study of 800 parents that was published recently, showed that 91% of them buy junk food when they go to McDonald's and Burger King and Wendy's. Shocks, you know, and so only 10% are actually, 9 or 10% are eating healthy meals. Now, the reason, among other things, is because the parents are eating junk food. I mean, the reality is, if the parents are getting a Whopper and fries, are the kids really going to get something that's healthier than a Whopper and fries? Maybe they'll get a junior Whopper and they'll get a junior fries.
Yeah, the parent can't exactly tell the kid, eat healthier food, if the parent is shoving unhealthy food.
Well, the parents actually do. I mean, they do say that. They do say, well, you're going to get a healthy meal. And the kids go, I don't want a healthy meal. I want to have what you have. And it's really an issue because fast food is a major source of calories, sugar, fat, sodium, and obesity.
Yeah.
I mean, and we have to talk about obesity because if you look at obesity basically in kids, especially kids who are kindergarten up until the age of 12, it's on the ballooning. And a lot of it is due to the unhealthy food that there is in fast food. So it's a big, big issue. And I think it's an issue parents have to think about before they go to a restaurant. And I think this is the time. There's nothing wrong with going, I am not going to say you shouldn't go to fast food restaurants, because the reality is people are going to do it. But you can do it in a thoughtful way. And if you do it in a thoughtful way, you can look at things and say, okay, we're going to get a burger. We're not going to get the special sauce, which usually has mayonnaise and has more calories. We'll get a burger, but we won't get fries, or we'll get fries and we'll split the fries. In other words, why not teach fast food responsibly? You know, I find this rather interesting because I was looking at a Budweiser commercial, and they said, drink responsibly. Well, I'm not a teetotaler. I mean, I'll have a beer or two beers. I do drink responsibly. I think it's the same with fast food. You can do it. And the reality is, children follow what parents do.
Yeah.
If parents smoke, children are more likely to smoke. If parents choose junk food, they're more likely to choose junk food. And just one interesting caveat, I still remember when I was doing hospital work, I had a young girl in for diabetes. She was 12 years old. She had new onset diabetes. She was morbidly obese. She was put on a diet in the hospital for 3 days while we regulated her. And her parents snuck in Burger King fries and Cokes to her when she was in the hospital until the hospital put a stop to it. In other words, they just did not get the picture.
Yeah. So good food for parents means probably more good food for kids.
Yeah, parents, kids follow what the parents do. Yeah. That's the long answer, and that's the short one.
1-800-462-7413 is our number. 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, my question is about hernia surgery, in this case, umbilical hernia. And my husband is planning a surgery. We've talked to the doctor, and it's a surgeon that seems very experienced and does not just general surgery, but she also does bariatric surgery and knows her way around there. And the hospital's the biggest hospital in the area and that we trust. But my question is about mesh, and mesh I developed a bad impression of because of all the stuff about the transvaginal mesh. And I understand this is a different place, not the, pelvic area, but I'm still kind of concerned about that mesh.
Uh-huh. Well, let's talk about your husband, first of all. So he has an umbilical hernia. That is a hernia around the belly button.
Right.
More than an outie. Is he symptomatic? How big is it?
Well, it sticks out maybe an inch or so.
Okay, an inch is pretty big.
Mm-hmm. And so he says it's uncomfortable, and I mean, it feels tight at times.
Okay.
He's trying to not bump it.
Uh-huh.
And he kind of feels like it's getting worse.
Okay. So you hit some major things about an umbilical hernia. First of all, is it symptomatic? There are a lot of people with umbilical hernias that are not symptomatic and they do not need surgery. They're usually symptomatic when intestine goes out through that hernia, gets stuck in the hernia, and people often, at that point, have to push it in. That's really a signal with the fact that it's something that should be treated. Is your husband overweight, underweight, the right weight? How would you?
He's not overweight, although the only weight he carries is on his belly.
Uh-huh.
So there is some fat there.
Yeah, men do tend to carry weight on their bellies, and women tend to carry it on their buttocks. Mm-hmm. And an interesting thing that I find when I have men who are overweight in my office, I'll say, "How are you doing?" And they pat their belly as if they're pregnant and say, "I have to get rid of it." And I was thinking today, I've never seen a woman pat her butt and say, "I have to get rid of this butt." It's very funny. I have no idea why men pat their bellies and say they have to get rid of it. Okay, so he's a little bit overweight. He's going to do that. You're concerned about a mesh. The transvaginal mesh, tell me why you're concerned about that.
Well, because I understand if it's a certain size hernia, you have to do that or else the operation ends up getting repeated.
Right.
But the problem is the mesh, it binds with your muscle.
Right. Oh, sure. It binds with the material. But I want to get back for a second. You mentioned transvaginal. So you've done research on that or
well,
had experience?
Well, I just know because there have been all these things about lawsuits for that.
Okay, so that is very different, though.
The doctors told me that was more likely, it's just more problems in the pelvic area.
You're dealing with something that's very different. When you look at the vagina and the rectum, which is something which you're doing and you're putting in a mesh, it really, first of all, I don't know if the mesh is the same. The mesh itself may be different. I don't know.
They're using polypropylene.
Well, but it may be manufactured in a different way. I'm not talking just about the material, the size, the texture of the mesh, what mesh they use, where that comes from, and why a woman needs a transvaginal mesh becomes a totally different issue. Sometimes it's because of radiation, because of surgery. Sometimes it's because issues that have occurred during childbirth and other things. So it's a very, very different operation, and it's for a totally different reason. So, for instance, the plastic that is used in a contact lens is similar to often plastic that is used in some joint replacement surgery. It's the same plastic, but a contact lens is different than some of the joint replacement surgery that may have some of this plastic in there.
Okay.
So I just want to mention that. It's not just the material. It's a lot more than that. How did you choose this particular surgeon? You're happy with the surgeon and the institution?
We called, and this is what we were scheduled, and we talked to this person, and she's neither young nor old, and she has experience, and she seemed like she knew what she was doing, and he liked her, and he's not worried.
Okay, so neither young nor old. That's the golden period within life where you are neither young nor old. So he was happy. Did you meet with the surgeon personally?
Yes, but in your practice, you're not seeing a ton of problems with people who have this kind of surgery and then have mesh problems?
No, I have not. And the fact is, if they're symptomatic, that's the issue. And that's why I brought that up at the beginning. The symptoms determine the surgery to me more than that. The presence of an umbilical hernia does not mean it has to be fixed. Mm-hmm. The presence of an umbilical hernia that is then symptomatic to me is a reason to fix it. And the reason is it's symptomatic and it causes problems. And it does tend to get bigger over time. And so the chances that the mesh will fail are greater the larger it is, because it's not just an infection and problem. It's just sometimes the mesh actually doesn't bind. It doesn't do what you want to do. I mean, there's a failure rate with surgery. I can't tell you what the failure rate the surgeon can tell you. Surgeons will often say, in my hands, it's less than that, and that's because they don't do the same number of surgeries to actually get those numbers. But there's a failure rate. It's not something I would necessarily trust to Google. I would ask the surgeon what the failure rate and where they get the information
from. I did ask. I was talking to a nurse because I call and add more questions.
Good.
So she said the complication rate was only half of 1%.
Complication rate is probably pretty small for an umbilical hernia, I would think.
That almost seemed too small, because I thought, well, they were lumping in all these hernias that are really tiny and stuff. I don't know.
Well, the complication rate for an umbilical hernia, because you're not dealing with very different from the vaginal hernia, is probably pretty small. I certainly would put it at less than 5%, and it's probably 1 to 2%. The success rate is the question.
Right.
But on the other hand, he's symptomatic. The success rate, I don't know what the number is, but it's undoubtedly based on how heavy the person is, whether they have diabetes, whether they're sick and healthy, whether they have good muscle tone, the size of the hernia. There are a bunch of things that end up going into the success rate. And then when you look at it globally, the failure rate and success rate, they're lumping in a bunch of other people in there. In other words,
it sounds like now we should just think about how to deal with trying to keep it from recurring, like what you do after the surgery.
Correct. So you bring up another really important point. You pay attention to what they say. So
okay.
If they say to do this, you do this. And if they say not to do this, you don't do that. And that, and you eat well, and you make sure you're as healthy as you can before the surgery.
Right.
That's what you do.
So. Okay. Thank you very much.
Good luck. Glad to walk you through this.
Thanks so much for that call at 1-800-462-7413. Now, before we take a break, Zorba, let's fire up the segment where you, Zorba, a real-life doctor...
I only play a doctor on the radio.
...clarify something a listener has read on the Internet.
Ooh, the Internet.
We call it Google Doc.
I need some marimbas. That's what I need. You've got to bring in the marimbas. I need that.
The following email came to us from Jessica in Algoma, Wisconsin. She writes, "Hello, Dr. Zorba and Mr. Clark." You like that, Mr.
Clark? Well, I like it. I like it.
So certain
it's
amount
very
of respect
nice. Absolutely.
That I never get
Absolutely.
From you or
That's
anybody
never,
else.
Never. No respect. You don't get no respect.
I'm wondering, says the listener.
R-E-S-E-P-C-T.
If you can tell me why I get cold facial sweating when I eat things that contain vinegar. There can be a variety of foods that cause it, such as salt and vinegar chips, green beans cooked with vinegar, and certain kinds of vinaigrettes. When I asked others in my family or friends, they kind of look at me like I'm crazy. So I did a little looking online and see people have mentioned they may have allergies to vinegar. Beside the cold face sweat, I don't have any other typical allergic type reactions when I eat the things with vinegar in them. Any thoughts?
No, I don't have any thoughts. I don't have the foggiest idea. I don't think she's allergic. She's not developing hives and the symptoms of allergies, but I don't know why with vinegar. You know, people have food intolerances. Now, why she should sweat? I mean, some people don't like vinegar. They get nauseous with vinegar. They feel faint with vinegar. They vomit with vinegar. I've never heard of anyone sweating with vinegar, but I do know one thing. I do know, because we have discussed this, that we will get emails from lots of people who have the same problem, and I promise you that when we get that, we will post it on Facebook, post it on a website, and we will discuss it on the show, because there are other people who have the same problem as you do, and my guess is they listen to this show.
Did you read something online that you're not quite sure about?
Huh.
No sweat. Zorba's
no
here
sweat.
To clarify the clickbait.
These puns are going to kill me.
Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at...
You think vinegar is clickbait? Zorba at WPR.org. Or, of course, on Facebook. If you haven't heard of Facebook, you are Rumpelstiltskin.
Our tasty recipe coming up, along with more of your calls, of course, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. You're on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Have a question for Zorba? The number is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, lemony zucchini pasta.
That's right. Now, how much on a scale of 1 to 10 do you like zucchini?
Can we do 1 to 20 or 1 to 30?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, zucchini as a dish, I don't think of zucchini as a main dish. Now, when I was a poor student, I would have stuffed zucchini. We would get zucchinis that were kind of large, but we would stuff them with things. I mean, we use zucchini sort of as the skeleton to put other good stuff in it, but I didn't think of zucchini as, gee, let's have zucchini tonight.
Yeah.
Although there are some, you know, there are some vegetables that really, you know, obviously command performance, like corn.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when you have sweet corn and it comes out, it commands a performance. We're going to have something with the sweet corn, and the sweet corn is the star, the star of the dinner. But zucchini, because it's not highly flavored, it doesn't have a texture that's really bright, it doesn't have the crunch of a carrot, it doesn't have sort of the water of of a cucumber. When you look at it, it's really, I don't want to say secondary, I don't want to insult any zucchini out there that's listening to me right now, or zucchini lover, but it really is almost a secondary vegetable, I mean, for many of us, except during zucchini season, in which case it always appears anonymous on my front door in a plastic bag from one of several neighbors that say, I can't believe how much the zucchini is growing. So this is a way to make zucchini good.
Okay.
It's a zucchini dish, and it's wonderful, and it's something you may want to consider. Mm-hmm. Okay. So start out with a pound of pasta.
A pound of pasta.
Ask me what kind of pasta.
What kind of pasta?
Any kind of pasta.
Okay.
It doesn't really matter. It could be spaghetti or bow ties or ziti, whatever pasta you want to. 2 tablespoonfuls of olive oil.
2 big T olive oil.
A shallot peeled and minced.
A shallot peeled and minced.
And if you don't have a shallot, that's okay. You can use a regular onion or a green onion, but you want to use just a small amount, not a large amount, not to overpower it. 3 cloves of garlic.
3 cloves garlic.
Now, I know that you're not the one who does the food shopping in the house. Actually, who does the food shopping in the house? The dog doesn't do the food shopping because you don't have a dog
anymore. Actually, I do food shopping.
You do the food shopping.
Yeah.
So do you ever buy garlic?
No.
Okay. Well, that's because you don't cook much. But if you do, frozen garlic is wonderful. When you get frozen garlic, You know, the garlic that's in a jar is good, but if you get a big jar, it goes, it just doesn't taste as good. But frozen garlic is wonderful. Mm-hmm. Three cloves of garlic or the equivalent, either frozen or in a jar, or regular garlic.
Three cloves garlic.
A zucchini sliced, a nice zucchini sliced.
A zucchini sliced.
A summer squash sliced.
A summer squash sliced.
A half cup of cream fraiche.
Half a cup of cream, what's that?
Fresh, F-R-A-I-C-H-E. It's kind of like sour cream. You could use sour cream instead. You could use a Greek yogurt instead. It's a dairy-based product that's somewhere between, it's not exactly whipped cream, it's not exactly sour, it's not quite as sour as sour cream. But if you can get it, that's great. But as I say, you can substitute yogurt or sour cream for that. Zest in a juice from a lemon. And let me talk a little bit about the importance of zest. A lemon, if you ever bit into a lemon rind, it tastes bitter.
Sure.
But a lot of the smell of the lemon comes from the rind. And when you zest it, you immediately increase the smell of the lemon without adding any bitterness to that.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. So let's make a deal.
Let's do it.
Bring a large pot of salted water to a boil. Cook the pasta according to the directions until it's al dente. Notice how I pronounce that? I pronounced it correctly for Gino out there who listens all the time from Milwaukee and corrects me. It's al dente. It's not al dante. I finally got it after all these years. Scoop out a cup of pasta water. You're going to set it aside and use it later. Drain the pasta. If you're moving a little slowly in the kitchen, toss the pasta with a teaspoon of oil so it doesn't stick. Are you a fast cook or a slow cook? That's the answer, isn't
it? How about a no-cook?
A no-cook. I love it. I love it. A no-cook it is. So in a large sauté pan, set over medium heat, add olive oil. When warm, add the minced shallot, garlic, and zucchini, and summer squash. Cook for about 5 minutes until it's softened. Add the pasta to the pot, along with the cream fraiche, or, as I said, sour cream or yogurt, that is unflavored yogurt. Add the lemon juice, a few pinches of salt and pepper. Then pour in a little bit of pasta water, probably about a quarter of a cup, to give it a good mix. Add salt and pepper to your liking. And when you're all finished, sprinkle the zest from the lemon right on top of it. Divide it among four plates or bowls and serve it. If you want to use a little Parmesan on top of it, you'll love it. And this is delicious.
It actually sounds good to me.
I can't believe it. It sounds good to
you. Except for the zucchini.
Except for the zucchini, it sounds good. If you want a copy of the recipe, go to ZorbaPastor.org. You can take this recipe, find it, other recipes at ZorbaPastor.org, or find us on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413 is our number. 800-462-7413. Now back to the phones we go, Zorba. A listener is with us in Edmond, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I've got a question. My son, he's about 3 years old, and he keeps getting fevers every other week.
Wow.
And every month he has a fever for 3 or 4 days, twice a month.
So tell me a little bit more about it. You bring him to the doctor. So he's a three-year-old. How was the labor and delivery? Normal?
Everything was normal.
Does he go to daycare?
No.
Does he have play dates with other kids?
No. And we've checked him out for fever or for viruses and stuff, and the tests always come back negative.
Always come back negative. How high are the fevers that he gets?
It's gotten as high as 104 and accompanied with vomiting.
Oh, yeah. When you have a fever that high at 104, vomiting certainly would not be unusual. How does he eat? Tell me a little bit about his eating patterns.
Eats good, lean, red meats, best fruits, lots of fruits.
Okay. So normal stuff. How many kids do you have?
Two.
How old is your other child?
Four.
Does your other child get sick? The four-year-old?
He does not.
So your other child does not get sick. This child gets sick and gets fevers all the time. What do you do when he has a fever? Tell me a little bit about how you treat it.
Tylenol and Advil, kind of stagger him.
Sure. And that's, by the way, that is a good way to do it. Advil lasts for every 8 hours, and in between you can give Tylenol, and that is really good for a fever. How often have you gone to see your doctor for this? How many times?
Oh, man. We've been at pretty much every time that he has a fever, we either take him to the ER or to his pediatrician.
And the ER is pretty much, I mean, that's not the best place to be ever, in the emergency room, obviously, with the child. So they, every time you go to the ER, they do blood work? Is that what they often do?
No. We've only gotten his pediatrician to do blood work one time, and they didn't, like, really run any tests besides white blood cell count.
Good. And that was not unexpected. Whatever they figured out, they didn't think much about it, or they have any comments about it?
They said nothing about it besides it looks fine.
Okay. So, first of all, and a little bit about the four-year-old. Does the four-year-old go to daycare or go to school?
He's started preschool.
He started preschool. Have the fevers been going on as long as he's been in preschool?
No, he just started pre-K this year.
He just started pre-K this year. There's a lot of good pre-K in Oklahoma. Oklahoma has the highest percentage, from what I've read, in pre-K in the country. You know, so congratulations, Oklahomans, for really stepping in and doing pre-K, which is really very good for kids. So here's what it is. Some kids get more viruses than other kids. In other words, we can only measure certain viruses. We can't measure other viruses, and some kids catch more. I want to figure out whether or not he's catching it. Doesn't sound like he's catching it from his sibling. Do you guys get colds? What sort of work do you do in your family?
I am a stay-at-home dad. I'm a disabled veteran.
Uh-huh. And your wife?
She works at a kind of like a daycare.
Mm-hmm. Does she get sick and bring that home? Does she get sick a lot?
No, she hasn't been sick in a long time.
Okay, so she doesn't get sick. Okay, I've got some advice for you. First of all, don't take your kid to the ER or the doctor very often. That's advice number one. Because your child now is getting viruses somewhere, is developing fevers, you've had enough visits to the ER and so on, so you can feel comfortable, my child just has a virus, and you can treat it at home. With the issue with fevers are you treat it exactly that way with Advil every 8 hours, Tylenol in between. Hydration, by the way, is extremely important, and that's the hardest thing. Pedialyte, if your child won't take, seems like they're dehydrated, is the best thing. If your child goes to the washroom, urinates, you look at the urine and see whether or not your child is hydrated, because that is probably the biggest issue. And eventually, kids who have multiple fevers grow out of it. And they are from viral infections. And your wife may not actually be sick, but may have some, viral infections that come. When she comes home, washing your hands, if she has any sniffles, making sure that she, washes her hands after she blows her nose and so on is what it is. And you should feel comfortable. Your child has multiple fevers. It will go away.
Yeah, she washes her hands religiously. And you don't think it, because we were... using the power of Google, periodic fever syndrome, or do you think it could be anything that could be genetic or?
No, I don't think so. And first of all, Google and the net is wonderful. It gives you lots of information. But some of the information, as you know, is good, and some of the information is biased and bad. I mean, that's the nature of it. Some children get fevers periodically from viruses that are around, and they just catch it automatically. They get fevers, and basically when they're adults, they don't do that. They build up an immunity. If your child is eating properly, meets developmental milestones, is active and does normal things that a kid does, it doesn't mean there's anything serious going on, and let me assure you of that. And that's because you've been to the ER, you've seen the pediatrician, you've gone to the emergency room, and the reality is when your child has a fever, you just treat it. In Europe, when kids have a fever, even if they have a red ear drum that's bulging, they don't treat them. They do not treat them with antibiotics like we do. Maybe they treat 15-20% of the ear infections. We treat 95% of the ear infections. We treat throat infections even when they're not strep. We give too many antibiotics. They don't do antibiotics in Europe. And their children grow up to be just as healthy as our children. The fever that you're treating really makes your child more comfortable. I would just sit with that. I wouldn't look any further and worry about an autoimmune disease as long as your child's developing properly. I think once you've got a couple of tests, I think I would just treat the fever and say some kids have more fevers than others, and I would take Google for him, and I would shut it off. Not uncommon. Okay. It does happen. You should feel comfortable and reassured. He's seen enough doctor visits, and that itself is a trauma for the family and the child.
Yeah, definitely.
So thank you very much, and thank you for your service.
Well, thank you, Doc. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we appreciate that care. Call at 1-800-462-7413. Now, before the break, Zorba, we love it when our listeners take to our Facebook page. Time again for Facebook feedback.
Facebook feedback.
Okay, Zorba, you recently posted a video on the official Zorba Pastor on Your Health Facebook page, and we're not sure if perhaps you mistakenly posted this video because, well, you are playing the accordion, and let's just hear a clip.
Hit it. Wait, that's enough.
Okay, listeners, in case you aren't sure what that was, let's play it again.
That's enough.
And of course, our wonderful listeners responded to your video with an outpouring of love and support. Here's a small sampling. First, Paula wrote, "Whoever that was in the background didn't let you get two words out before saying, that's enough." And Jerry in Wisconsin wrote, "Maybe you should use this as an opener for the show. Tom would love it for sure."
Yes, I used to play accordion when I was a kid. Found it in the basement. I was with my best bud, Dan. Pulled it out and said, "Can you play anything?" And that's about as far as I got. That's exactly it.
Okay, Mary invoked one of our theme songs by writing, "Disagreeing with the Doc. Oh, oh, oh." And Gina in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, shared this. "That brings back so many horrible memories from when I was locked in the basement as a child to practice the accordion."
Locked in the basement.
The worst part is I never got any better. Okay, Zorba, a few more. Justin in Tennessee wrote, "I used to play accordion, but not like that." And finally, Bobby in New York sums it up nicely with, "Nice, but don't quit your day job." Okay, Zorba, let's end this segment with my favorite accordion joke. How do you protect a valuable instrument?
I don't know how.
Hide it in an accordion case. Thanks for all the Facebook comments, and let's keep it going. And, of course, you can always send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
More calls coming up, as well as an interesting topic, all coming up on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Back to the phones in a little bit at 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, a study on limiting kids' screen time.
Right, right. Well, we've talked about screen time before. We talk about it a lot.
Yeah, we do. That's
and
right.
That's the reason is it really started with you and I. How old were you when you first got your TV set?
12.
12. See, and I was 5. You know, I was 5 years old. And the issue with TV is you look at it and you watch it. Don't you remember watching test patterns on TV?
Oh, God, yes.
I mean, watching test patterns. How dumb could it be?
Yeah.
So what happens is a TV doesn't produce much, doesn't produce imagination, doesn't stimulate the mind.
Yeah.
The issue is screen time for kids because, obviously, we have more than television. We have lots of things. Smartphones, computers, screens are really everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular study is an observational study funded by the National Institute of Health looking at nearly 5 5,000 kids aged 8 to 11 published in the journal Lancet, a prestigious journal. They looked at cognition. They looked at how kids learn and how kids think. And they looked and they observed it based on Canadian guidelines. An hour of physical activity for kids. That can include recess at school. It's moving around. Less than 2 hours on the screen and how much sleep they're getting. And by the way, very few kids actually hit all of these milestones. Mm-hmm. And the evidence suggests a number of things. The evidence, first of all, suggests physical activity produces increased academic performance. We want our kids to excel in school.
Yep.
Getting them out for physical activity means removing them from the screen. When you're looking on the screen, it is not physical activity, right? We know that by definition.
Yeah.
We also know 8 to 9 hours of sleep at night in bed improves academic performance. We want that for our kids. And while we're there, by the way, breakfast is really important in school, too. They need calories. Mm-hmm. But the third thing is limiting screen time. And the reason why limiting screen time is important is because you're not engaging in social interactions on screen time most of the time. You're not engaging in physical activity for sure on screen time. And you don't learn anything on screen time. You're not using your brain. Yep. And that's what we're looking at. You got to use your brain, especially as it's growing.
We talk about this a lot, but the problem just seems to be getting worse all the time.
Well, I don't know if it's getting worse. You know, you look back to the Greeks. They complained about their progeny, too, saying they're not doing enough. But it is, I think, to some extent, it got worse once we had television, frankly. And I think that this is just a variation of that. And people say, well, I don't let my kids watch TV, but I let them on the smartphone. The study found only 1 in 20 children in the U.S. met all three guidelines, sleep, physical activity, and reduction in screen time. And 1 in 3 didn't meet any of them at all. So I think this is the time for parents to take charge, to cut down their screen time, to interact with their kids, to engage in physical activity, and to take the bull by the horn, because this is how you get smart kids.
800-462-7413, our number, 1-800-462-7413. And back to the phones now, Zorba, a listener with us in West Lafayette, Indiana. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Calling to ask about different eating and nutrition plans, particularly weight loss plans. And I haven't heard too much about this plan on your show, the ketogenic eating plan. I'm wondering just about where you and Zorba stand on its value proposition and what kind of evidence you found, medical evidence, that it's a good plan to sustain for an extended period of time.
So you're concerned about your weight, I take it?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And what sort of diets have you tried in the past?
Oh, boy.
More than one. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, the ketogenic diet is the latest fad. But let me go back to when that fad started. The fad started in 1967 with this Dr. Stillman, who wrote The Stillman Diet. And I don't remember exactly the title of the book, but I remember the doctor's name. It was Dr. Stillman. And he developed this concept of once you reach ketosis, which means actually often that you're burning protein within your body. But once you actually reach ketosis, that you're often maybe burning protein as well as fat within your body, you'll do something. And he had the concept that you have to drink 8 to 10 glasses of water a day. He wasn't the first person to say that, in order to get the toxins out of your system. And as long as you start to eat food that are more ketotic, and you would measure ketones by buying strips in the store to measure ketones. And once you had ketones, you'll begin to burn that fat. And this is really, you know, he sort of started this. And roughly probably every 5 to 10 years, the diet resurfaces. Nothing wrong with the diet at all. Nothing wrong at all with a ketotic diet. But it isn't necessarily better than any other diet. And the problem with diet is not necessarily taking off the food initially. It's keeping off the food, you know, taking off the weight initially, but keeping the weight off later on. How much weight do you want to lose?
Around 30 pounds.
And where do you think that those extra calories come from? Do you have any idea?
Well, I do like sweets,
mm-hmm.
And I love potato chips.
And you love potato chips. So you like sweet and you like salty. I mean, potato chips are salty and sweeter. How much have you taken off with other diets?
I think my most successful diet, which is the diet that I stuck with the longest, was Weight Watchers. And I took off, this was maybe 15 years ago, and I took off around 15 pounds.
With Weight Watchers. So a bit about this. The New England Journal of Medicine, a number of years ago, looked at all different dietary plans that were out at that time. They found a few things. First of all, they found that yo-yo dieting, going up and down in weight, was not harmful to you. There was no evidence of that. You know, for years, doctors said, well, it's not good to take the weight off and put it back on. And the answer is that's bogus. There's no evidence that does you any harm. I mean, it is good to take it off and keep it off, but you do no harm by taking it off and putting it on. The second thing they found, they were looking scientifically, was that kickstarting diets with something like Jenny Craig, you know, the diets where there's a dietary plan and you're eating artificial food. It's not artificial, obviously, but it's food that's actually for you and you don't have any choice in what you're doing, is an okay way and, frankly, was the only thing that showed some benefit 2 years later. That's the way you measure a diet, is the weight off 2 years later. That's sort of the standard of measuring diets. And the third thing they found was, other than that, every single diet had about a 5% success rate. Some might have gone as far as 10%, but they all had about a 5% success rate. We don't know why. We do know it has a lot to do with habit. We tend to eat too much. We know that when the body goes into a famine mode, which is what we do with dieting, it extracts more calories out of our body during that time. But medically, we don't have a good handle on diets. I send people to the nutritionist all the time, and they don't lose any more weight than if they're on the ketogenic diet, the Atkins diet, any other diet that happens to be out there. So I'm not against a ketogenic diet to kickstart things if it works for you, but it's very hard to stay on anything like that more than a few months. People just don't do it.
Yeah. So what do you think about the meal plan kits? I tried a meal planning kit, and the thing that I liked about it was portion size were pre-measured.
Absolutely.
There was a lot less weight.
Absolutely. Okay. And it's actually those meal planning kits that were the only thing scientifically shown to work. I mean, those, frankly, that's what it showed in this review article, that the meal planning kits made a difference, and the non-meal planning kits did not. So that actually was the most successful way of losing weight. Weight Watchers, by the way, is very good. I always recommend it to people because they have a very sensible diet. And once again, the thing about Weight Watchers is some people can keep it off, but it's only 5 or 10%. But if you started with meal planning and then you kicked over to Weight Watchers directly or Weight Watchers online, you might keep off that weight.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Welcome. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for sharing that.
We appreciate the call at 1-800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, why don't you break out your robe and gavel and saddle up to the bench for a segment we call Judge Zorba. Today's case comes...
Ooh, don't have any music?
Oh, you have the gavel.
Oh, I got the music. Yeah. You know what I need?
I should have paused for the gavel.
I need drum music. I need... See, I've got something there, but I've got to have some tune to go along with. Gotta do it. So, okay, got my gavel out.
Okay. That wasn't that impressive, actually.
It wasn't, you know, because that's why I can't keep tune. But I did keep a beat there.
Today's case comes to us from Lucinda in Medical Lake, Washington. She writes, my husband is paranoid about any marijuana buying or using. Mm-hmm. I'm recovering from a car crash with a broken thumb and knee. I had my daughter, a school teacher, buy me some CBD THC cream for the pain. Mm-hmm. My husband is convinced it could jeopardize her job, life, or future to buy such an item. I live in Washington State, where marijuana is legal. I say it is legal, therefore no problem. Do you agree with my husband or me?
Well, first of all, it's legal, so there is no problem, you know, buying it in Washington State. The real issue is the cream. I don't think the cream is dangerous to people, and I recommend people try it. The feds have put a kibosh on a marijuana testing, so we can't really test it to see if it's mm-hmm. worthwhile because you have to jump through so many hoops. Some people say, yeah, the cream works for me. Now, is that the cream or is it the placebo effect? We don't have any double-blind studies to actually show that. And once we actually have some double-blind studies, we'll see if it's worthwhile. But whether or not your, you know, your daughter can buy it legally in Washington State, so, you know, I don't step into the morass of legality when it comes to marijuana. I'm a doctor, not a lawyer, nor am I a da-da-da-da. Real judge. Yeah. I only play one on the radio.
So you think the husband is wrong?
I said I'm not a real judge. Sometimes we come down right in the middle with the gavel and we go bang, bang, bang.
Have a debate you need settled? Add your case to Judge Zorba's docket by sending us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Now, before we head out today, Zorba, we love it when our listeners offer up helpful information or interesting ideas. So here are a few tips we recently received. The first is from a listener who signed it, Hitch and Kelp from Outer Space. Zorba, I listened to your story about milk of magnesia being used for a deodorant. Years ago, I made my own Greek yogurt, a 22-hour culture, and one day I ran out of deodorant, so I used my homemade yogurt. I just put a little on each armpit, and I smelled like nothing for most of the day. Of course.
But wait a second. I got to say something. Sometimes you may smell like nothing for the whole day, but other people, you smell like something for the rest of the day.
Of course, he says, it doesn't last as long as normal store-bought deodorant, but the bacteria gets rid of the funky bacteria, and it's great to use during the summer to cure that incurable funk that you smell even after a shower. The only downfall is a co-worker said, I smelled like a cake.
Hey, if it turns you on, it turns you on.
Finally, Zorba, this one came to us from a listener named Jeannie, who listens to the show on Montana Public Radio. She writes, Hi, Zorba. I love your show. On a recent program, a caller mentioned microwaving sponges to disinfect them. I do this once every couple of weeks. I put the sponge and a few drops of dish soap in a quart of water and microwave it for about 8 minutes. Do you know, is there any research on this?
You know, the research is the bacteria pretty much are still in there. And when the sponge gets funky, it's time to toss it.
Do you have a helpful tip for us? We're always happy to soak it up. Just post on our Facebook
These
page.
These puns are going to kill me.
Or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org or through Facebook.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or through Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For more Zorba Pastor on Your Health, including episodes, recipes, and tips mentioned on the program, visit ZorbaPastor.org. This year, we're celebrating the show's 25th anniversary, and we want to hear from you. How has Zorba helped you out? What have you learned from the show over the years? Leave us a message at 800-462-7413.